Honestly, I can't preach a sermon this morning about anti-racism and multiculturalism without naming that yesterday, less than an hour from here in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, there was a KKK rally. The good news is indeed, as she named, that the rally was small, involving only four men, but they were wearing the white hoods that have become so infamous. And although overt racism continues in our country and may even be on the increase of late, it has thankfully declined since the height of segregation. But that decrease in overt racism has led far too many people to miss the more insidious racism that remains. This morning's spoken meditation invited us to notice the ways that language shapes our perceptions of the world and can unconsciously contribute to having positive associations with the color white and negative associations with black. Many of these associations reflect an aspect of the systemic racism that remains entrenched in our society. The battle is not done just because we've elected our first black president. But when we take a step back, it's so obvious that on the archetypal level, the colors black and white both represent vital parts of the human condition, and it becomes quickly obvious that we need both, dark and light, everywhere in between, yin and yang. Nevertheless, the color bias remains in our vocabulary, and social scientists have developed an implicit association tests to scientifically document the ways, even here in the 21st century, that this bias manifests in our unconscious. You can go to, I'll put the link in the sermon manuscript on our website, but you can go to implicit.harvard.edu and you can take the test yourself online. To date, studies show using this implicit association test that 75% of its takers, including some African Americans, have an implicit preference for white over black. So associations done with that force you to make decisions unconsciously and quickly. And the implications of these findings are troubling, as they've done studies to say, so what are the real world consequences of this? As the Washington Post wrote, an automatic white preference has been found to correlate with, to just give you three examples, suboptimal treatment for black emergency room patients, as people make snap decisions about who to give attention to and who to take seriously, unfavorable judgment of black job applicants, and laughter at racist jokes. Relatedly, many of you were here back in February when I preached a sermon and led a congregational conversation in response to Michelle Alexander's important book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in an Age of Colorblindness. And of course, that colorblindness is in scare quotes. Google Stephen Colbert and colorblindness, and you'll get some good unpacking of this whole idea of being a colorblind society. If you've not read that book, I encourage you to do so. It was the common read selected last year that was recommended for all Unitarian Universalists to read, to study, and to act on. For now, I'll limit myself to quoting only three statistics from Alexander. The first is about our growing prison industrial complex. In 1972, that wasn't that long ago, in 1972, fewer than 350,000 people were being held in prisons and jails nationwide, compared to more than 2 million today. We've gone from 350,000 to 2 million. The second two quotes are about the racial bias with which our present prison industrial complex is being built. No other country in the world imprisons so many of its racial and ethnic minorities. No other country in the entire world. The United States imprisons a larger percentage of its black population than South Africa did at the height of apartheid. Today, there are more African-American adults under correctional control, in prison, in jail, on probation or parole, than there were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. For this morning, my point is that the shock myself and many other members of this congregation felt when we really begin to wrestle with the extent of this racial injustice in our country today is another indication that there are barriers and there are biases, both conscious and unconscious, that are inhibiting our work for racial justice and allowing racial injustice to take hold of our country. There's one other important point I need to make about that February sermon on the new Jim Crow. In that sermon, I mentioned that many decades ago, this congregation became a lifetime member of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And members of this congregation have been involved at various points in working with the Frederick branch of the NAACP. In response to our invitation, some local members of the NAACP came to our discussion of the new Jim Crow, and I said that if this congregation were to become serious about anti-racist work, a strong first step would be to start attending local NAACP meetings, to be an ongoing relationship, not just with individual people of color, but with an organized group of people of color. And along these lines, UU scholars have noted that looking at the few UU congregations that have become more racially integrated, which a lot of people will say if less than 80% of your congregation is more than 20% of your congregation is people of color, then you have become very different than the norm, which is, you know, way upwards of 90% of one color in most congregations. So looking at those few UU congregations that have become more racially integrated, the most successful have been visibly active in race relations in their communities. That's what they're known for over a long period of time, being active in race relations in their community. And in the months since that study of Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, members of this congregation, particularly Phyllis Liddell, you heard her earlier speaking about minimum wage, have been continuing to work with members of the Frederick NAACP. She's recruited at least 38 members of this congregation to pay annual membership dues to join and support the NAACP, so that gets you on their mailing list, increases your awareness about what's going on. She plans to attend the Maryland NAACP State Conference at the end of this month in Ocean City, along with the secretary and president of the Frederick NAACP. If you're interested in joining in this work, I'd encourage you to talk with Phyllis. If you don't know her, again, I'd be glad to introduce you. And Phyllis shares the anger and sadness that myself and many others feel when we read those statistics about the extent of the new Jim Crow and of our prison industrial complex. And she and others are taking, however, the all-important next step of asking, what is the one next concrete step that I can take to reverse this injustice? Not just, let's get rid of it tomorrow, but what's one thing I can do? And then what's the next step? And what's the step after that? And I've been reading a lot about the history of racial justice work among Unitarian Universalists, and a related piece of advice that stood out to me is from the black liberation theologian James Cone from January 2001, when he was participating in a three-day invitational consultation on theology and anti-racism that the Unitarian Universalist Association held in Boston. You can read the highlights of this conference in a really excellent book titled Soul Work: Anti-Racist Theologies and Dialogue. As you can imagine, about most things where you have three UUs, you have eight opinions, and that's certainly the case about what to do about anti-racist work. There's a lot of ideas. It's hard work, but it's important work. And knowing how slow progress can be against entrenched inequalities, Cone offered both caution and encouragement. He said, set your pace as if you're going to do this work for the rest of your life. Set your pace as if you're going to do this work for the rest of your life, but also know that there's a joy in this work. There's a joy in this work because it enhances your humanity. And when I look at charts designed to evaluate progress toward what it would look like to work toward realizing Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream of a beloved community, a multicultural beloved community, my sense is that we're in that messy middle. For example, I feel fairly safe in saying that we as a congregation see ourselves as committed to inclusion. We're comfortable with official pronouncements regarding diversity. Not all congregations are. And it's a vital first step to name that we don't want to be part of the problem of perpetuating 11 a.m. being the most segregated hour in this country. But as we saw earlier with the spoken meditation, there are ways in which we, even Unitarian Universalists with all our good intentions, have been unaware of habits of privilege and habits of paternalism that have inhibited our racial justice work. Let me say a little more about what I mean. The evidence is clear over the past few decades that Unitarian Universalists have made significantly more progress in our congregations in gender equity and in LGBT equity than we have in regards to racial equality. It's just the data is there. We've done way better about, there are way more female ministers in our congregation, there are way more LGBT folk at all levels of our institutional life, congregation, nationwide, than when you look out and see people of color in our congregations. The data is just starkly different. And it's not because we haven't been trying, so the question becomes, what have we been doing wrong? Mark Morrison Reed is a UU minister who has written extensively both about his experience growing up as an African-American in Unitarian Universalism, which he calls a white denomination, and about the history of African-Americans in Unitarian Universalism. He invites Unitarian Universalists to consider that we're much more of a tribal and ethnic group than most of us are unconscious of, So you can debate with Morrison Reed, you may or may not agree with him, but he invites us to consider that we may be more tribal and ethnic than we're aware of. Consider this scenario. If you're walking down the street in a large city and past congregations that are Filipino Baptist, African Methodist Episcopal, a Catholic church with Spanish services, in each case, we would easily be able to identify the tribal and ethnic characteristic of each in turn. The language differences, the differences of what's going to be on the wall, the differences in the rituals and the songs. And for most of us, if we were to visit one of those congregations, it would take significant time and effort to become acclimated to all the cultural differences in an African Methodist Episcopal congregation, a Catholic church whose services were all in Spanish, or a Filipino Baptist service. Morrison Reed invites us to have eyes to see that despite our best intentions, there are significant ways in which most of Unitarian Universalism remains a white, middle-class, professional, Eurocentric monoculture. And those who are not white, liberal, European-American Protestants have to do a similar sort of cultural work to fit in that would be required for a white European to fit in a Filipino Baptist, an AME, or a Spanish-speaking Catholic service. And if you remain unconvinced of the ways in which too much of UUism has a white bias, I invite you to go home and Google stuff white people like. And consider that website in light of Morrison Reed's point. It may help you become more aware that white is as much a culture as black or Latino or Hispanic or Asian. To support his point, Morrison Reed points to how much easier, again, it's been for white women and for white LGBT folk to find a place in our congregations than it has been for people of color. The reason, he says, and I think rightly, is that white women and white LGBT folk already share white cultural norms of Unitarian Universalism as UUism currently stands. And these insights remind me of a time in seminary when we were focusing on multiculturalism and racial justice work. I remember asking one of my African-American classmates if she would tell us more about some of the times that she had experienced unintentional racism in our divinity school. And I appreciated the candor of her response. She said, "Honestly, that sounds exhausting. I can't save all you white people. You need to figure out a way to save yourselves." And I've thought a lot about what she meant over the years. And this gets, I don't know if we have time for that. It gets into archetypes about, archetypally about historically of black people looking to white people to do things for them and to save them. And it gets into some really messy, unintentional, playing into some psychological tropes that are really unhelpful. But I think another part of what she's saying relates to what Unitarian Universalists sometimes call the journey toward wholeness. Limiting ourselves to Eurocentrism undercuts the very ideals of Unitarian Universalism, of radical interdependence with all people and all things, the beauty of diversity, and the centrality of justice and equality for all people. Along those lines, let me complicate matters just a little more, because I know that's what you're looking for. Decades ago, the struggles for gender equity led us to see that the word man is inadequate to refer to both men and women. And at this point, gender-inclusive language has become so standard, at least for me and for many others, I can't even imagine returning to the old patriarchal norm. It just doesn't even make sense to me anymore. We have a new norm of gender equity and gender-inclusive language that's extremely life-giving. Likewise, many of us have become increasingly skilled at understanding the necessity of spelling out LGBT, that you can't just say gay and have that, you know, be the umbrella term, that you even see now LGBTQIA for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, intersex, ally, asexual, depends on who you talk to about what all those letters stand for. But as we look toward becoming more adept and welcoming in regard to multiculturalism, many racial justice advocates point out that saying people of color and having that be our umbrella term, that masks really important distinctions between African Americans, between Latinos and Latinas, American Indians and Asian Americans, each of which also has their important subgroups. And in particular, many Latinos and Latinas point out that a lot of the language, even that Unitarian Universalism has done and methods of analysis around racial justice work, has been really limited and helpful in white-black relations, but there's a whole other set of concerns that Latinos and Latinas bring. For instance, you get people saying, our issues have more to do with culture and language than with race. Thus, one UU General Assembly workshop suggests, and I think we should perhaps consider doing this, that one small first step, and remember that, it's not about saying, how do we end this problem tomorrow? It's saying, what's one next step? And then what's the step after that? And then what's the step after that? So they said that one small first step in becoming more welcoming to Latinos and Latinas, it would be just to add, si habla español, to the name tags of members in our congregation who speak Spanish. And I think that you might be surprised at the number of people in our congregation who speak Spanish. And that's one small step that we could begin to take. But we also need to name that the journey to wholeness is long. But the vital part is to stay on that path toward inclusivity, toward welcoming, toward multiculturalism, and to continue building bridges and relationships of interdependence across difference. And yes, there are other vital issues along with racism, war and violence, classism, climate change, to name just a few. And as daunting as each of these issues is alone, we make a mistake if we see them as in competition with one another. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said that the triple evils of poverty, racism, and militarism are forms of violence that exist in a vicious cycle. They are interrelated. They are all inclusive, and they stand as barriers to our living in the beloved community. We need coalitions to face these interlocking oppressions together. And although we do have a long way to go, although we need to confess that we have stumbled in the past in our racial justice work, there is also much in our collective history to encourage us. In 1870, Meadville Theological School, one of our major UU seminaries, admitted its first African-American student. In 1889, Joseph Jordan was the first African-American ordained as a Universalist minister. In 1954, A. Powells Davies, the minister of the All Souls UU congregation in D.C., posted a list of integrated restaurants and requested that members only eat at these integrated restaurants. In 1962, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was invited to deliver the prestigious Ware Lecture at the annual Unitarian Universalist General Assembly. In 1965, James Reeb, a 38-year-old white UU minister from Boston and member of All Souls UU in D.C., answered the call to march for civil rights in Selma. He was beaten by white segregationists and died 2 days later. He's one of our martyrs. Dr. King preached his eulogy. I encourage you to go online and read it. Our challenge becomes not only to know our history better than we do and to own our history, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the beautiful, but also to take the next steps inspired by that history, learning from that history of making history in our day to make a better world for ourselves and for our children. For now, I will close with these words from Peter Morales, the first Latino president of the Unitarian Universalist Association. He writes, "The tragedy, and it is really a tragedy, is there are tens of thousands of Latinos, African Americans, and Asians, and increasingly people who come from mixed ethnic and racial backgrounds who are UUs and don't know it yet. They are isolated, religiously homeless people. These are people who are living in two cultures, often feeling as if they belong in neither. They need the kind of community that we provide, and we need them. They are the natural, cultural, and religious bridges to our diverse future. But we do not reach these people well enough. And especially, we don't invite them to our congregations often enough. Morales writes, and he's now the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, the first Latino president. He writes, "I'm a recent UU, but I would have been a UU 20 or 25 years ago if someone had invited me. My dream for Unitarian Universalism is that we confess that we don't already have all the answers. We need to admit that it's hard work, that anti-racism, anti-oppression, multiculturalism, that is as rigorous a spiritual discipline as we will likely ever encounter. And I dream that we will begin a conversation, a deep spiritual dialogue, which we're calling that book Soul Work, about how we can learn to be open to each other and to work together to create a culture and a community that celebrates all of what it means to be human." That's that journey toward wholeness. We not only have gifts to give, we not only have gifts to give each other, we are gifts to each other. We must not forget that. Our journey toward wholeness has just begun. We're not sure of the way. We've often lost our way in the past, believing our destination was in sight and easily reached. We were a bit arrogant and a bit naive. We're wiser now, and we know we'll not get there soon. And we know that we need to walk together and to walk humbly. Laura said it earlier from Micah, do justice, love mercy, walk humbly. So Morales writes, come, let us make that journey together. One step at a time, paso por paso, hand in hand, mano a mano. Come, leave no one behind. Together, we can make this journey. Come. And as we struggle to commit ourselves ever more fully to solidarity with all people in the struggle for racial justice,